It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. The January 6th investigations are taking several turns lately that could further expose whatever role Donald Trump himself played in the crimes and the attempt to undermine the peaceful transfer of power on that day. The Supreme Court, maybe you've heard this, is allowing the subpoena to stand from the January 6th Congressional Committee for Trump documents pertinent to the case. No executive privilege for evidence in a thing such as this. There's an investigation by law enforcement in Georgia. This is really interesting and new, over the Trump phone call caught on tape to the top state elections official. You know him, Republican Brad Raffensperger, who's been in the news. Trump asking Raffensperger to find enough votes to reverse the result. The attorneys general of New Mexico and Michigan and a congressman from Wisconsin have all asked the Justice Department now to investigate cases of fake electors. These are suddenly in the news much more, though it's not new that it happened. These fake electors, people saying they were going to vote for Trump in the Electoral College from states that Joe Biden won. And there are several investigations at the state level in New York more relevant to Trump's business practices, potential real estate or tax fraud that Attorney General Letitia James has just released evidence from in recent days. And we are happy to have back with us now the former hosts of WNYC's beloved podcast, Trump Inc., Ilya Meretz and Andrea Bernstein. They are now both NPR reporters. They've joined the mothership covering Trump legal cases for NPR. And they're also making an investigative podcast about January 6th for Pineapple Media. I'll say that Ilya is currently joining us from Newark Airport, where he has a flight to catch momentarily. So for the first time in my life, I'm going to root for a flight delay, but he might have to leave early. And Andrea, we should say, is also the author of the book, American Oligarchs, the Kushners, the Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. So Andrea and Ilya, great to have you back on the show. Welcome back to WNYC.
So great talk to you, Brian.
Let's start with the Supreme Court. And Ilya, since I don't know how long we'll have you, if you want to dive in first, what did they allow the January 6th committee to see and why might it be significant?
What the Supreme Court said basically is that a lower court ruling, which cleared the way for the National Archives to share requested materials from the White House with the January 6th committee, the Supreme Court declined to take that up. They said that that lower court ruling can go ahead. And we know that the January 6th committee is really interested in building a picture of what was going on in the White House, not only on January 6th, which of course is, of great interest, but also what was going on in the weeks and months beforehand, as people like Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell and General Michael Flynn were in and out and talking up their notion that it had been a stolen election. We know it was not a stolen election, but very much talking up and spitballing ideas about what could be done.
And what are the potential crimes, Andrea?
So this particular Supreme Court decision wasn't about any possible crimes. It was about whether the January 6th Select Committee has the right to see the documents. They have no enforcement power. And what is really interesting to me about this Supreme Court decision is that, as we know, because we talked about it many, many, many times, when the Manhattan DA tried to investigate Trump, Trump sued, the case went to the Supreme Court twice. That took 2 years. This took just a few months for the Supreme Court to say something very interesting, which was they didn't even want to address the issue of whether a former president could assert privilege. They just said, fine, he doesn't even have a basis for privilege, so we're not even going to take that up, and the committee will get these documents. And it has already started to get these documents that Trump was hoping to keep secret. So that is a very accelerated schedule compared to what we're used to.
Andrea, how do the politics and the investigations intersect, in your view, either to give any potential criminal charges more fuel or in ways that make prosecutors reluctant, perhaps, to look political, you know, when real crimes may have been committed by the former president?
So there's a couple of things that are going on at the federal level. The January 6th committee has only the power to get to the truth. They can refer matters to the Justice Department, but they have no prosecutorial or law enforcement power. We do know that in the case of Steve Bannon, who refused to cooperate with the committee, that they referred his case to the Justice Department, and in fact, the Justice Department indicted him, Bannon, for refusing to cooperate, and that case will work its way through the courts. But there's no remedy. There's no Bannon can be prosecuted, but there's no way to make him turn over the documents. So there is that intersection, and then there's sort of what the Justice Department under Attorney General Merrick Garland is doing, which seems to be taking a very, very measured approach to criminal investigations. So they just last week made their most serious indictment in the January 6th attack, which was a seditious conspiracy charge against members of the Oath Keepers. But there's no indication that they're investigating the Trump administration. And it's unclear where Biden is on the issue of should he look back, should he look forward with investigating Trump. I mean, it's a very, very complicated thing to indict a former president, and something that I think Biden has indicated he does not want to do. So that is what is going on regarding January 6th. And then separately from that, there are all these New York investigations. And I think as much as the Trump family would like for people to understand that it's all one big ball of wax and it's linked, these are very distinct. These New York cases are about Trump's business. They are in many cases about things that happened before Trump were president. And those cases are moving forward, both the civil case by Attorney General Tish James and the criminal case by the Manhattan District Attorney.
Ilya, I was wondering, after the Supreme Court decision the other day saying Trump needs to turn over the subpoenaed documents to the January 6th committee, what about all those other people defying subpoenas to testify? Steve Bannon, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Mark Meadows, who was chief of staff on January 6th, based on Trump's executive privilege claim.
Well, I'm not a lawyer and I don't know all the ins and outs, but I should add that what the Supreme Court said was that the National Archives can share those materials, not that Trump must share materials that are in his possession, but actually all these White House records that have to be handed over when there's a change of administration, you know, they go to the National Archives. So, you know, stuff that the chief of staff, for instance, Mark Meadows, you know, his notebooks should be with the National Archives, for example, or schedules of advisors to the president. Ivanka Trump, for example, should be with the National Archives. So that's the material. It's going to have to be fought out in the courts for everybody who resists. And, you know, Bannon's the first one. I don't think his lawyers will be happy that the Supreme Court declined to take this up. But each case has its own specific set of interests, and Bannon's assertion of executive privilege, which a lot of people thought was overreach, I don't even know if he would have been covered by that. So,
Andrea, anything to add on that?
Well, I think what is really astounding to me about this committee is that, you know, as you know, this was not the nonpartisan 9/11 style commission that a lot of people wanted. A lot of good government groups and Democrats, and in fact, 35 Republican House members voted for it before it was killed in the Senate. So what is astounding to me is that this is a committee that's controlled by Democrats. There are 7 Democratic members plus Representative Cheney and Representative Kinzinger. And what is astounding to me is how much cooperation they have gotten. Last week, when the committee sent its letter requesting information from former senior White House advisor Ivanka Trump, the committee excerpted notes from an interview it had with General Kellogg, who was in the room with Trump when he was speaking to Mike Pence. And what that tells me is that they have for all of the focus on people who haven't cooperated, hundreds of people have, and they have many, many, many documents, and they frankly made a lot more progress than I thought was possible when they started their Select Committee investigation.
Listeners, who has January 6th investigation-related calls? Questions for Andrea Bernstein and Ilya Meretz, now covering Trump legal cases for NPR, as well as producing a January 6th related investigative podcast for Pineapple Street Media. 212-433-WNYC. We're going to get into these fake electors. We're going to get into the Georgia case, which I find really interesting. 212-433-9692, or tweet your question at Brian Lehrer. Let's take a phone call right now. Jim in Morris Township, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, good. Yes. Are the fake electors the electors who would have been chosen if Trump had carried the states, or are they totally other persons, not the electors who would have been chosen on Election Day if Trump had carried the state?
Thank you. Ilya, are you on the fake electors story enough to answer that question?
I'm not, but I will just say that it's amazing that every week we learn a little bit more about the plans that people had in place, that Rudy Giuliani and others were putting in place to have alternate slates of electors, and we know it's something of great interest to the committee. So I wouldn't be surprised if we learn a lot more in the months ahead. But I don't know if it was the specific same people. Yeah. Honestly, the Electoral College is as much of a mystery to me as it is to most Americans.
What's the Rudy Giuliani hook there?
Just that Giuliani had been in and out of the White House so intensively in that period. I mean, so, you know, it's a day that Andrea and I have thought a lot about in working on our podcast project was, I believe it was November 7th. It was the Saturday that the election was called for Biden. And you'll remember at that very hour, Rudy Giuliani was holding a press conference at a garden center on the outskirts of Philadelphia. And one of the reporters called out a question to him. He didn't know that the election had been called. And he responded very belligerently. And you know, maybe in that moment, it looked a little ridiculous to people who understand how elections actually work. But that really marked the beginning, as far as I can tell, of Giuliani's campaign to really discredit the election that had just happened in the minds of people, mounting lots of legal challenges, talking all the time about voting machines, really spouting theories that are totally ridiculous. But because America's mayor was saying them, some people believe them.
Mm. Andrea, anything you want to add to that? You covered Rudy Giuliani ever since he was mayor.
My God, who would have thunk? Who would have thunk he would be in all of our lives for so long? I do know that some of the people who were to have been official Trump electors objected to being on a slate of fake electors, if you will. I don't know whether there was some overlap. But one of the interesting things that we learned when the committee sent its letter to Rudy Giuliani, which it recently did, asking him for documents and testimony, was that they have sworn testimony under oath that he directed the program of trying to put together fake elector slates. So this is, again, a case where, despite the resistance, they have witnesses. They have fact witnesses who are giving information about what people like Rudy Giuliani, Ivanka Trump, and others did on January 6th and in the days leading up to it and weeks leading up to it. And I think, one of the things that obviously they're circling around to is exactly what Donald Trump was doing. And I think that's sort of, it's kind of like where their efforts are clearly focused. What happened exactly on the 5th, on the 6th? What did he tell people? What did he order? Who did he speak to? That's what the committee says it's going for.
Andrea, can you give us a little more of a primer on the fake electors, sort of fake electors 101? I mean, the Electoral College is the Electoral College. So when people hear fake electors, the first thing they may think is, oh, these people who are from states that Biden won were going to sneak in and, aha, they're really going to vote for Trump and throw the election. But they couldn't do that. So who are the fake electors in terms of what the intent was?
So the theory that is emerging and, you know, evidence and documents and testimony that have been released from former Justice Department officials and others suggests that there was a play by Trump and his allies to prepare slates of fake electors so that electors from some of the swing states could be rejected, that there could be an argument made that there were competing elector slates. Therefore, the whole thing would have to go to the House of Representatives, and then there would be a state-by-state vote, which at that time, January 6, 2021, had 26 Republican states and 24 Democratic states, meaning that the Republicans could have won. So that is the theory. By having these alternate slates of electors ready, they could sort of pop them in, say there's a dispute, it can't be settled, so we have to go to this alternate constitutional mechanism.
So that's not a crime. That's more of a political act of subverting faith in our democracy and our electoral system?
Well, we don't know. And various states have asked the Justice Department to look into whether this is a crime. So it is conceivable that there is some kind of criminal activity there. We don't know whether the Justice Department is looking into that. But I think that the bottom line is you can't subvert an election. And that certainly was attempted by some people on January 6th. And the question is that we still don't know the answer to is how high up did that go? And was there an organized conspiracy?
Let's take another phone call. Charles in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Charles.
Thank you, Brian. It's been a whole year since I've talked to you. I'd like to say that I think that Trump has a big debt with Putin. At a presidency, he was saying, love Russia. And he let Turkey do a number on the Armenians, which Putin became the referee of after it happened. And I just think he used those people for January 6th to send a message to Putin that he still had control. And thanks a lot. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay. Thank you very much. I don't know why he would have needed to convince Putin in particular at that point, January 6th, 2020. But Ilya, I've been thinking of you recently with Ukraine in the news so much and the possible coming Russian invasion of Ukraine. You had gone on a reporting trip to Ukraine that was Trump-related just before the Trump first impeachment on trying to pull those dirty tricks that had to do with Ukraine. How quickly we forget that, right? So,
yes.
Is any of that still in play? Go ahead.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's actually really stunning to sort of watch the developments because it really feels like we have picked up in Ukrainian politics in a place that we'd sort of left off for about a year with a new president, and now we're back in that same place when the UK Foreign Office released a list of, I think, four or five names of figures who they said were going to be part of, you know, a potential new Russian-backed government in Ukraine. I quickly went back to the documents from the trial of Paul Manafort, and I found most of those names in those documents. They were, you know, people Paul Manafort worked with, wrote speeches for, campaigned for, back when Manafort, who was a Trump political consultant in his previous life, had been working for Russian-backed or Russian-oriented political parties in Ukraine. So it seems that we are very much in that same place. I did message a couple of my fixers from when I was there in the fall of 2019 just to take the temperature with them. This was a couple of weeks ago, but they both sounded kind of skeptical about an invasion, which gave me a bit of hope. I'm going to follow up with them today and see if they're still feeling the same way. I think people there have been sort of threatened for so long with this kind of thing that there may be people who just think it's not really going to happen like in an actual active military conflict, even with the conflicts that already exist in Ukraine. Russia already occupies quite a bit of Ukrainian territory around Donetsk and and in Crimea. But I think maybe there's a sense that, you know, that's over there, but it's hard to imagine, you know, Russian forces actually coming to Kiev or to the outskirts of Kiev.
A few more minutes with Ilya Meretz and Andrea Bernstein, who hosted the Trump Inc. podcast about the intersection between Trump's business interests and the public interest back when he was in office, that WNYC podcast. Now they're reporting on Trump legal affairs for NPR and producing an investigative January 6th related podcast for Pineapple Street Media. Andrea, I want to get to this Georgia story. Development from just the other day, Thursday. Here's the Guardian version of the headline. Georgia prosecutor seeks special grand jury into Trump's election interference. Subhead, DA requests subpoena power to compel testimony from witnesses such as Brad Raffensperger, who Trump asked to, quote, find 11,780 votes. So I'm going to replay the famous clip, because that phone call was caught on tape after the election. Trump trying to get the Georgia Secretary of State, an elected Republican, to flip the results. Here it is.
I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
So, Andrea, what's new here? People have heard that clip for months and months and months. What's new here from Georgia about that?
Well, what's new is that there's, now clearly a criminal investigation that's been escalated to the grand jury stage. And typically, that only happens when a prosecutor believes that they are going to be able to prove a crime. So it means that the case has moved forward. That is what happened in New York, for example. When the case went to the grand jury, it was clear that the DA felt pretty confident in his case. So there is now a criminal investigation in Georgia, and there's an ongoing criminal investigation in New York, which that case, as everyone knows, resulted in the indictment of Trump's chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, and two Trump entities. And that is an ongoing investigation. Both the New York Attorney General, who's involved in that investigation, and the Manhattan DA have made clear that there may be more indictments coming in the New York case. So the criminal problems are mounting. And what is so interesting about the Georgia case is obviously, I mean, while it's not directly January 6, it is related to the former president's well-documented attempts to thwart the will of the voters and to change the outcome of the election through whatever way he could. And one of the things that we've learned over the course of the last year through depositions that have been given by former Justice Department officials is the extent to which the former president said, okay, I want you to investigate fraud in Georgia. And at first, you may remember, the former Attorney General Bill Barr infamously said, yeah, okay, like we'll investigate the fraud. And his thinking, as articulated to his colleagues, was that we won't find the fraud and then it'll go away. And obviously that did not happen. They didn't find the fraud. And Trump kept going to more and more and more people saying, look for fraud, look for fraud, look for fraud. And when it was repeatedly not found, that's what led to this phone call. Just find those votes, because you and I both know that that was actually the outcome. And that is essentially what the former president said.
And that may wind up being a crime in Georgia, or it may not. We'll see what the grand jury says and whether an actual indictment comes down from that. I did read in that Guardian article that Secretary of State Raffensperger there said he would not testify in this case without a subpoena. So that's a power that a grand jury has to possibly get Brad Raffensperger on the legal record. All right, one more call. Andy in Westchester, you're on WNYC with Andrea Bernstein. Ilya had to go catch a flight at Newark Airport. Hi, Andy.
Hi. So, much as I'd like to see Trump get what's coming from him, I mean, if you talk to people in New York real estate, they'll say that he he could have been prosecuted decades ago for various things. But I'm just worried that
you know, that it may in some way strengthen him if he's seen as being a martyr. His movement has already been making martyrs out of people like, you know, Ashley Babbitt and et cetera. And I'm just wondering if that inhibits, well, what effect that has on the people that are trying to investigate them and whether they worry about how they're proceeding and trying not to make it backfire, I guess.
Andy, thank you. Important question, Andrea. We've got about a minute left.
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things on that. First of all, the answer that they've given when I've put to them directly, and Ilya and I actually spoke with the former Manhattan DA, Cy Vance, before he left office, was that that is just not part of his thinking. And I am going to take them at their word because
You're not supposed to charge somebody or not charge somebody based on political considerations.
Right, exactly. So I don't see any sign that that is actually there in this case. And to the caller's question about, you know, he could have been indicted years ago, I would say the following, and something that I wrote a lot about in my book, that Trump assiduously courted law enforcement in New York, going back to when his family business was basically in Brooklyn, and the Brooklyn DA, and the Manhattan DA, and sort of controlling the levers of power and giving to the favorite charity of the former Manhattan DA, Bob Morgenthau. Now, Bob Morgenthau's associates say that didn't have any effect on anything, but it was a very conscious thing by Trump that he gave money, that he showed up when they needed him to show up, that he invited people to his wedding, to his daughter's wedding, and that they came. And that he really sort of, these things that are alleged were alleged to have been happening for a long time. And the current indictment in Manhattan, going back to 2000, going back 15 years, 16 years, these crimes, this widespread crime, a fraud scheme is alleged to have gone on. So I think that it is true that Trump really thought about Manhattan, and he's still thinking about the Manhattan cases. If you look at all of the legal actions against him, the place where Trump is really spending money on really serious, well-respected lawyers in their fields are these criminal cases and civil cases in New York, which tells you something about their importance to him and the way they're concerning him.
Even though they're not January 6th related, which they're not, right?
They are not. They are not. These New York cases are related to his business model, and the allegation in Manhattan is that there was a widespread fraud scheme going on, that Donald Trump's company, his eponymous company, was cheating the U.S. government while he was heading that government. The scheme is alleged to have gone on up until June of 2021. So that is what he's being charged with. Or excuse me, that is what his company is being charged with. He himself has not been charged. And both his CFO and his corporate entities have pleaded not guilty.
Andrea Bernstein, who besides reporting on Trump legal affairs for NPR and working on a new January 6th related podcast with Ilya Meretz, is author of the book American Oligarchs, the Kushners, the Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. Andrea, thanks a lot. Great to have you back.
It's great to speak with you, Brian.